Welcome to Season 4 of The Great Humbling. My name's Ed Gillespie, and I'm a futurist, a poet, and a recovering sustainability consultant. In the spring of 2020, during the first lockdown, I began recording a series of conversations with Dougal Hine, co-founder of a school called Home. We started with a question. What if it makes sense to think of ourselves as living in a time of humbling, being laid low, brought down to earth? Pulling on that thread has taken us further and become more central to our work than either of us expected. So we're back now with an open-ended series as part of the wider patchwork of homewardbound.org. Thank you for listening.
Here we are, episode 5 of our more or less monthly fourth series of The Great Humbling. It's been a bit less than more, hasn't it, Ed?
You are indeed. I think, like mice and our fellow men, our best laid plans have gone slightly astray. But I was thinking about this, and perhaps we're a bit like an open space facilitation event. Whenever it happens is the right time, and whatever is said is what needs to be said.
That's a nice way to look at it. Yeah, I know. I definitely hear from people when we haven't done an episode in a month going, is there going to be one next month? Have I missed one? So here we are. It's May. Last time we sat down to record one of these, I was midway through a not very sensible writing sprint. I started in mid-February with 5 chapters of the book written and a total word count of 8,000 words. 8 weeks later, I'd written and revised another 21 chapters, a total word count of 63,000 words. And on the Wednesday of Holy Week, I sent off the manuscript. 2 days later, by Good Friday, the accumulated exhaustion and knock-on effects of having barely taken a weekend off in 2 months just flattened me. And I felt like I was falling to pieces, not fit for public consumption or even human company.
And on the third day, you rose again.
It took a bit longer, to be honest. But I mean, somehow by the following Tuesday, I had picked myself up enough to get to work putting up scaffolding with Jack, our carpenter and community builder in all senses of the word. And we've been getting on with this year's project on the Red House, the big old barn at the bottom of our garden. And so we took down all of the panelling off the gable end, and we're in the middle of replacing that, as well as boarding out the floor of the Great Hall. So by June, we'll have the whole of the upper floor of the Red House as a functional space. As Jack said, you'll be able to run a Hoover over it from one end to the other, which is a step forward. And the aim is to be bringing it into use step by step, year by year. So next year's project will get us to the point where we have 4 4-bed dormitories on the ground floor, and we're beginning to be equipped to be hosting courses here on site.
Now, that'll be amazing. And I have to ask, is the passability of a Hoover a standard test in the evenness of floorboarding? And I'm assuming the Hoover's passage might have been a bit more off-road before your works.
To be honest, the Hoover's passage might have been a bit more vertical. I mean, I'm not wanting to alarm any would-be visitors, but part of the story of the Red House is there was a fire there in the mid-1940s, and there must have been a very dramatic night in which they fought to save this structure, and they did save it, and it's in good condition, generally. But the hall was being used as a store for the shoe shop, so they didn't exactly repair the floor to a standard that you'd want if you were inviting the public in, let's say. I had a moment last week that brought things into focus. We're working on the timber frame of the building that we've exposed by taking down the panelling. And there are bits to strengthen. There's a frame to put in for a fire escape door at that end. There's a patch that was needed on a tie beam where there's been some rot. And Jack says, well, this is the first work that's been done on this frame since the house was built in 1924. So let's make sure the work we do will see it through its next century. And, I mean, there's no guarantee there, because that fire in the 40s, well, that could easily have destroyed the whole building. But it is a thing to be part of work that is intended to outlast you. And then I find I'm thinking about the other side of this, which is you're also the custodian of an old building. And you've literally named it the Mill of Impermanence. So I guess that's a reminder that the building itself isn't going to be around forever.
Well, yeah. I mean, there is something, as you say, about stewarding an old building during your brief ownership of it, which is just a mere fraction of its long life. You know, my mill's almost 3 centuries old, you know, but it's actually only the core beams and superstructure that is that venerable, because the cladding has obviously been replaced many times during its life, so like some sloughed off snakeskin. So it's a combination of very old and rather new. And I'm constantly contemplating, as you and Jack are, like the next round of reparative interventions to keep the old girl going. And I think dwelling in a place like this is a very live and active relationship with the passage of time, which has to be sort of filled with tender acts of love and attention, very much akin to what you'd call a living culture connection with my home that is literally schooling me in old ways. I mean, and that said, you know, it's lasted this long and will no doubt outlast many modern homes being thrown up around the place. And there's endurance within the impermanence with the right care.
So I've had an idea for an episode that came to me earlier this year. And I had this sense one day that I wanted to talk to you about belief, something that's haunted some of our earlier conversations, weaving in and out of them. And I'm thinking of the episode on prayer in series 3 and the state of grace episode in series 2, for example. But it's also that I'm struck by the journey that some of our mutual friends have been on in recent years. I mean, I'm thinking, obviously, of Paul Kingsnorth and Martin Shaw, both of whom have become Christian. I sort of want to say, come out.
Well, there's something I've been meaning to tell you, Dougald.
At this point, nothing would surprise me. But there is something going on, something that I've noticed more widely, a pull towards commitment, towards a costly faith rather than a pick and mix spirituality. I've heard people voice that kind of thought in different conversations and different contexts over this past year or so. And as I'm thinking about this, I remember 20 years ago when I was a journalism student interviewing Rowan Williams a few months before he became Archbishop of Canterbury. And I was asking him some questions about the decline of church going and the diminished role of religion in people's lives. I remember him saying, I think sooner or later, most of us find ourselves faced with the question, what would I stake my life on? What is more important to me than simply my own survival? So I guess that's where I wanted to go with this episode, to ask each other, what are you willing to stand for? What do you believe? Where do you want to start, Ed?
Well, I've always thought of Rowan Williams as more of an arch-druid than an archbishop, but that's probably a slightly different conversation. But, I mean, in playful answer to your question, I don't know whether it's something I'd stand for, but it's something I definitely believe in, is self-delusion. And I know that sounds sort of paradoxical and slightly oxymoronic. I believe in self-delusion. But I think, actually, this idea goes really deep. I remember seeing a talk by Professor Bob Trivers, who is a fairly renegade evolutionary biologist whose life story basically defines the word maverick. I mean, you can look him up online. He's pretty colourful. This was a talk he gave at the RSA a few years ago, and he was promoting his book, which was entitled Deceit, How We Lie to Ourselves in Order to Deceive Others. And the premise of what he was saying has sort of crept through the dark corridors of my subconscious ever since. Yeah, and made me think a lot about my own self-delusion. And in this talk, he was citing a famous experiment in which vocal homophobes had erection detectors placed on their members.
Can we just pause there for a moment? This is a thing, an erection detector.
Well, apparently, yeah.
It's not just a euphemism, like someone was sat there with their hand in a particular position. Sorry.
Yeah, with a measure ready to go.
Sorry, I got derailed by that image.
I'm sure it's all done with lasers. which sounds hazardous.
But don't try this at home, children.
No. So these vocal homophobes had erection detectors placed on their members and were then shown gay pornography. And what the study showed was that their arousal aligned with their homophobia. The more vocal the hate, the higher the state of arousal. And clearly something quite profound was going on, where this degree of internal self-denial and self-loathing was leading to an external projection of prejudice. And once you sort of get into that, it's hard to unsee that in many respects. But similarly, we know personal environmental footprint, you know, is pretty linearly related to income. So the more you earn, the bigger your footprint, pretty much. And despite the fact that people with professed eco-consciousness are usually those with higher education and higher levels of income, these are also the people with the biggest impact. So you have this sort of delusional paradox. And equally, I was talking to someone the other day when we were discussing the fact that actually to be in the top 1% of global earners, in the UK, for example, you only need to be earning 80K. Now, that's a lot of money, but that basically puts you on the same sort of category that most people think oligarchs are on. But that puts you in the global 1%. And then the top 10% of global population in terms of those incomes are those responsible for 50% of that global lifestyle carbon emissions. So it really feels like this is a do as we say, not as we do type of mindset. I'm sure you probably dug into this in your book in some respects, Dougal, but you know, I think these are actually quite dangerous delusions, which get us stuck in that sort of marginal incrementalism that masquerades as progress, you know, and even when you see these kind of relative decoupling of carbon emissions from revenue in business, which means they can still emit more absolute carbon whilst claiming success in terms of the reduced intensity of emissions. I mean, to put it crudely, it's frankly bullshit. And I guess at the kind of the most fundamental level of self-delusion, it's the base level denial of death, you know, back to this idea of impermanence. And our own denial of mortality is the ultimate manifestation of comfortable self-delusion. So, I mean, I could list endless examples of this, but I mean, I don't know, Dougald, do you agree? Do you believe in self-delusion?
I suppose I believe that self-delusion is inevitable to some degree, and also that it's unevenly distributed. There are always things I won't be able to see from where I'm standing, including things about myself. And there are also practices, ways of being and doing, that can limit the extent to which we're captured by delusion. So it's possible to live in relation to truth, I believe. But that looks more like humility than like certainty. It involves an awareness of the way that lies are always going to be creeping back in, and a willingness to own our own foolishness, to laugh at ourselves in the moment when we catch sight of the gaps in our awareness, the moments where our delusions are revealed, rather than trying to cover these up at all costs. So I guess that's what I'd say about self-delusion. And you're right, it does overlap with some of the stuff that I'm talking about in the book about dissociation and the sense of, you know, the gap, the lack of connection between parts of society or parts of ourselves. But if we're going to talk about beliefs and about our own beliefs, then I think I should start by rewinding a bit. Because it's not a secret, but I don't know if I've talked about it in our conversations particularly, that I grew up around church. My dad was a United Reformed Church minister for 35 years until his retirement. I spent the first 2.5 years of my life living in a converted boat shed in the grounds of a theological college in Cambridge. And it was, I've come to reflect in hindsight, as close as you could get to the kind of village childhood that many human beings have had in many times and places in the middle of a late 20th century Western city. Because we were living in this tiny two-room building, but I could toddle out the front door into a garden and a set of neighbouring buildings that were an environment of safety, surrounded by adults who knew me and knew each other and who my parents knew and who were part of a community of meaning. And if you were to say that a good part of who I am and what I do is rooted in a longing to find a way back to that garden, I don't know that I could tell you were wrong.
Well, Dougald, A good part of who you are and what you do is rooted in a longing to find a way back to that garden.
Thank you, Ed. I can't say you're wrong. But no, I mean, I grew up singing hymns and praying and reading the Bible and seeing my dad stand up in front of a room full of people on a Sunday morning. And you know, one legacy of that clearly is that it never occurred to me to be nervous about standing up in front of a room full of people. And so I was marinated in and formed by those surroundings. And it wasn't the kind of countercultural religious experience that some people have. And what I mean by that is I have friends who grew up in churches or other kinds of religious community that were very consciously in a kind of antagonistic relationship or a defensive relationship towards the wider society. And that definitely wasn't the kind of church that I was around. But I do remember telling my Sunday school teacher when I was, I don't know, maybe 12, that I didn't find hell a particularly helpful concept.
So not at all precocious then, you know. I'm sort of wondering what their response was. Was it sort of Father Ted-esque, you know, that would be an ecumenical matter?
Oh, we didn't use words as long as that. No, not in Sunday school anyway. As far as I can remember, she looked at me with a sort of baffled expression and said, I don't think anyone finds it a helpful concept. And maybe I was displaying early tendencies towards an unhelpful degree of abstraction. But I think what I meant was, I can't see how a threat of a place you go after death, if that's what you read the things about hell within the Bible and within the Judeo-Christian traditions, you know, I can't see how that's any help in being true to the things that did matter to me about this tradition that I was growing up in. But if I were to draw out, at least as a starting point, a belief that grew out of that upbringing, and I guess there are two things that I remember landing on by my late teens at that, you know, that age when you know everything. So the first thing was, I remember saying to some friends, it doesn't matter much what I believe. What matters is what I believe makes me do. In other words, a belief needs to have consequences, or it doesn't deserve the name of belief. It's just an opinion with a particularly high opinion of itself. So that was one place that I got to. And the second thing was a thought that I had around the same time. We need God like the X in an equation, because to put anything more defined in that place is to court ruin. And I mean, there've been few years since when I would talk so freely about God, but I don't think I can disagree with my 18-year-old self about that. I mean, Paul Kingsnorth has this image of the throne. He says there's always a throne at the heart of a culture, and the question is what you put on that throne. And I think that's what I was getting at, that we need something vast and boundless and beyond description to put in that place. Because if we put anything smaller there, then we're in trouble. And that's what the language of God can sometimes point towards. So yeah, in the spirit of the inheritance tracks they do on Radio 4 on Saturday mornings, I'd say that that's my inheritance of belief. How about you, Ed? You got any inherited beliefs? Anything that comes from the family you grew up in?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm not sure I'd put this on Paul Kingsnorth's throne, but brick shit. Now, and yet you have to sort of bear with me a bit here, but this comes from my roguish late father, ironically, Father Ted, who used to regale a tale of an LSD experience in which, whilst tripping, he had distilled the answer to life, the universe and everything, as you do, down to two words, which is an artful elegance in anyone's reckoning. And being an astute cultural historian, he'd obviously written down this, what Roots Maneuver would call colossal insight, onto a piece of paper for posterity, which, blinking in the cool light of the following day, he'd rediscovered to receive the world-changing epiphany of brick shit. So, you know, I mean, so far, so Ted.
This wasn't a premonition of the political events of 2016, was it?
I can't. Well, Brexit. I mean, funnily enough, I mean,
we like, voted for Brexit.
Yes, the last 6 years has felt quite Brexit, hasn't it? But my brothers and I loved this story, you know, as it sort of punctured some of the pomposity of the dafter end of the psychedelic experience. And perhaps, you know, it's another example of self-delusion, you know. So, oh, I had this colossal insight and it was Brexit. Now, the story gets a bit more interesting, though, in terms of my dad, because, I mean, he shuffled off this mortal coil in 2016, dying quietly in his sleep, which, given the noisy and sleepless way he'd lived most of his life, was slightly ironic. But fast forward to March this year, and I'm now renting my attic bedroom at the Mill of Impermanence on Airbnb and attempting some very vague thematic styling, which, as you can probably guess, is not really my forte. Never had much by way of aspiration to interior design. But the thematic styling I was putting on this room was involving octopus. And as a former marine biologist, you know, careful pods were one of my big passions. So I'd found some octopus lamps, you know, I'd got an octopus printed blind for the bathroom, blah, 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 blah. And I also sort of curated a cephalopod, a marine-themed bookshelf from my library. So classics like John Wyndham's The Kraken Wakes and Cy Montgomery's Soul of an Octopus and Peter Godfrey Smith's Other Minds, The Octopus and the Evolution of Intelligent Life, some really light-hearted reading for my guests. And obviously, octopus have got everything to do with an old flour mill, just as a kind of weird juxtaposition. But I was idly googling octopus books to bolster this shelf, and I stumbled upon this novel, The Octopus Man by Jasper Gibson. So I bought it, and a few weeks later it got added to the Sundoku pile of unread books next to my bed, and I finished something else. I thought, oh, come on, let's give it a go. It was really gripping, and it's a brilliant tale of mental health. The central protagonist is a schizophrenic who believes his will is controlled by an octopus god from another dimension. I mean, obviously, that's quite a belief to be carrying. Anyway, one evening I'm reading the book, and Tom, the schizophrenic, is describing an acid trip he once took on page 175. And the passage goes like this. And I was tripping on a heavy dose of mushrooms and ket. Very heavy. I had this vision. The whole universe is a book. And the book became a chapter. And the chapter became a page. The page became a paragraph. The paragraph became a sentence. And finally a word. The whole universe. The whole meaning of the universe in a single word. And I knew I was on drugs, so I decided to write it down in case I forgot it. And then the trip went on and on and on. Anyway, next day, of course, I'd forgotten the word. And I ripped up my whole room looking for that bit of paper, but eventually I found it, and guess what the word was? And as I'm reading this, you know, I'm sat downstairs, I'm in the mill, my daughter's asleep, it's quite late at night, all the hairs on the back of my neck go up. And I pause and I take a deep breath before turning to page 176 for the reveal, which, of course, is Brexit. And I mean, okay, Jasper Gibson has distilled it to one word rather than my father's two. He's just created a wonderful amalgamation. But I mean, I laughed out loud, you know. I mean, I really couldn't believe it. So I've reflected on this. You know, what could possibly be going on here? And I'm reminded of your line that you often quote about a joke the universe joined in on, because I was thinking the universe is now sat on its backside laughing right now. And I sort of concluded there's a few possible explanations. One is like the Brexit story is actually a counterculture story that my dad co-opted and made his own. Now, that's possible, but it doesn't sound like my dad, to be honest. He had plenty of great stories, and he really didn't need to hijack someone else's. And I think he would have told it as someone else's rather than made it his own. I mean, the other option is that actually the author, who's a similar age to me, Jasper Gibson, heard my dad's story, second, third, fourth, fifth hand, and liked it so much, and he decided to weave it into his book. And I've tried to sort of get in contact, actually, just to ask him. I'd really love to know what the source of this is.
If anyone who's listening to this knows Jasper Gibson, then yeah. Can you help get in touch with him?
Yeah.
I'd love to know the answer to this mystery as well.
Exactly. And then thirdly, and perhaps the most apposite reason for our current conversation, is those who know, know. And the convergent thinking of revelation uncovers the truth of existence as actually being brick shit. So whatever the connection, whether it's sort of prosaic or cosmic, I mean, I love this experience because it plays to that Jungian idea of synchronicity that we've mentioned many times. Not least when I was talking about Brian Eno and the pub of the long now and all the unlikely alignments, connections and encounters that occurred during the adventure of the community buyout of that pub. And maybe because our so-called consensus reality is actually total chaos, that is somehow the natural disorder of things and the establishment and perception of patterns is all just a projection of the human mind. But when these strange confluences and eddies of meaning occur, we seize on them as evidence of higher powers or mysterious forces or the latest trend of manifestation. I mean, I don't know, but I guess I do believe in that synchronicity, even if it's just for the wonderful feelings of magical possibility I experience when it happens.
Yeah, I mean, it is something we keep coming back to, isn't it? I'll say this much. I don't believe in coincidence. There's too much pattern in the world, too many experiences that feel like clues. It's not just that synchronicities happen, it's that they cluster around significant moments in our lives, moments that have consequences. And I'm thinking just now about a whole string of events in the hours and days after I finished this book. Maybe I'll tell that story when it's had a little longer to settle.
I genuinely look forward to hearing that one.
But for now, I want to pick up the thread of my own journey with belief, because there's something here too about the nature of the times in which we find ourselves and the roles that come with that. When I say that I grew up around church, there's also a sense of growing up around an ending. Mm-hmm. If I look at my dad's service as a minister, it can feel like he was serving the last generation for whom Christianity in some form was still part of the background fabric of society in places like the places where I grew up. Whereas by our generation, religious belonging was something decidedly strange, something that set you apart. And I did a book a few years ago with the artists Robert and Jeska Brechevich, also known as Performing Pictures. It's a book called The Crossing of Two Lines. And the collaboration came about because there'd been this turn in their work about 5 years before we met, where they'd begun working with artisans in Mexico and in Croatia, where Robert's family come from, to make these video icons, moving images of the saints. And they'd install them in roadside chapels or in churches, as well as sometimes showing them in galleries. And when they did bring this work to galleries and art spaces, it made people who knew them and who knew their work really uncomfortable. And the way I put it in the book, we used to work that takes up the symbols of religion in ways that seem calculated to offend the people to whom those symbols matter. But when it comes to the people who actually go to galleries, it's more disconcerting to be faced with religious imagery that doesn't seem calculated to offend. The viewer finds themselves frozen between two thoughts. Is there a joke here that I'm not getting? Or is the artist trying to convert me? I don't think either of those are what's going on with Robert and Jeska's work, but they are participating in a tradition of devotional art that takes seriously what might be going on in the encounter with the saints in these villages in Oaxaca or on the island of Raab. And I remember something that came through in a conversation with Robert that we published in the book. At its best, Robert was saying, religion can weave a knot between the depths of mysticism and the rhythms of the everyday. Because within any religious tradition, it's a small fraction of those involved who are the ones who go down into the depths. But the stories and practices and rituals and community interweaves those experiences with the life of lots of other people for whom this is part of the backdrop of life. And obviously, that's not always how religion shows up or how it shapes people's lives. But Robert's point was, when that falls away, when within a few decades you go from a society in which a lot of people go to church, or whatever the place of worship is, to a society in which that's something weird and marginal, the loss doesn't really fall on the mystics. Because, to be honest, those of us who are drawn to the deep waters are going to end up there by one route or another. Mm. It's the wider community that feels the loss, though it may not be able to name it.
Yeah, it's that web of meaning, isn't it? Whether you're at the centre or the periphery is beautiful, but fragile and perhaps all too easily torn away.
Well, I guess my version of that is that I sort of stumbled through my 20s, still holding onto the edge of this religious tradition in which I'd grown up, not feeling very good at it, but with some residual sense of duty, and going through phases in which I was quite regular in attendance at a local Anglican church or a Quaker meeting house or wherever it was. And then I distinctly remember one Easter Sunday at Evensong in Sheffield Cathedral. I would have been 29 or 30. And as I sat there listening to the familiar passages from the Gospel, I had a sense that didn't come in words. But if I had to put it into words, it would be something like, I'm listening to a joke that's been retold so many times, passed on over and over, until everyone's forgotten that it's a joke and that this bit is the punchline. And I don't particularly want to explain or defend that as a statement, let alone make it into a theological position. But the effect of that experience was of being released from duty. You know, whatever my relationship with God or Jesus or the stories and prayers and hymns that I'd grown up with was going to be, I had been relieved of any obligation to these institutions or to a public identity of being or trying to be a Christian. So if I'm going to formulate that as a belief, I'd say that I believe religion often ends up resembling a joke that has fallen into taking itself seriously. More than that, actually, I believe that there's something in the nature of a joke, the experience of getting a joke, that takes us deep into the strangeness of what it's like to inhabit a world like the one we find ourselves in.
Yeah, well, I think Brickship pretty much sums that up in terms of a potential joke to be repeated. I mean, it also plays to another idea that I think I do believe in, which is the power of comedy. You know, and with my other podcast, The Future Noughts, you know, the way that we try to satirize and disarm and help people sit with discomfort using humor, which allows people to reflect on and see different perspectives or even as a sort of somatic release, you know, it can be literally the best medicine. I think there's definitely something there. And, you know, if you go back to a classic like Monty Python's Life of Brian, which was obviously accused of dangerous blasphemy at the time. But actually, it's a brilliantly sharp spiking of what you're describing, where you find this sort of playful happenstance turned into pompous seriousness and people sort of forgetting that originally it might have been done with a raised eyebrow or a wry smile and instead has become incredibly solemn and earnest.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, what happened after that point was that I found myself able to go off, you know, journeying with different traditions, not least, and you know, we touched on this now and then, the kind of adventures on the wilder edges of Hinduism with Vinay Gupta and various other characters, which, hey, I learned a huge amount from those experiences. And I mean, just right, one example, as it was taught to me anyway, is what I came to think of as, well, I came to think of it as an example of metaphysical good manners, metaphysical etiquette. And it was this understanding that, you know, if the if the fundamental nature of reality is godness, you know, the divine, and everything is kind of a manifestation of that, then everyone you meet is a god in disguise. Mm. Right? The whole of reality is kind of God, plural and singular, dressing up and participating in this kind of almost like kids play acting together with the intense seriousness and playfulness that can go with that. So, but if everyone you meet is a god in disguise, then you ought to be very careful about how you treat them. Because if you treat them as what they look like, if you treat them as something less than divine, then don't be surprised if the force that comes back at you is the force of what's underneath rather than the figure that they appear to be cutting in the world just now. And that was just, you know, as a navigational tool for how to inhabit the world, that feels to me like it has truth in it. And you know, I can find equivalents of that. There's plenty within Christian tradition, actually, about, you know, the stranger, the beggar, the person in need who you meet being Christ in disguise. Feels like, without oversimplifying into saying everyone's saying the same thing in different words, because I actually don't believe that. But there are commonalities, there are motifs, there are understandings that echo or rhyme backwards and forwards across different traditions. So when I say that I don't actually believe that everyone is saying the same thing using different words, which is the kind of kumbaya, happy, easy Coca-Cola advert, Benetton advert version of, you know, trying to just be nice and get on between all our different beliefs and traditions, is something that was something that brought this into focus for me relatively recently. You know, during the first lockdown in the UK, around the time that we started this podcast, I did a course with my friend Charlie Davies. And you know, Charlie and I have known each other most of our lives, more than half our lives, and worked together a lot. And I love him dearly, and I've learned a huge amount from him over the years. And you know, I've seen him go on this journey from this kind of pop sensibility that he had as a journalist and writer and instigator of things when we were in our 20s, into traveling a long way with Taoism and Buddhism and, you know, really going right down into the depths or out up onto the mountain, however you want to put it, and then bringing back using the same gifts that he had, that he was using to write articles about pop culture when we first were working together, using that same gift to translate, to carry across the borders of times and languages the heart of what he finds in the traditions that he has stood in and learned from. So in this course, we were working with this text called A Teacher's Advice on How to Be Clear, which is Charlie's version of a 1,000-year-old Buddhist teaching text called Advice from a Teacher's Heart. And for 42 days, I was walking alongside that text, taking a verse each day, listening to a recording of Charlie's reflection on the verse, sitting with it until something opened up for me and I could write something about what it had led me to. And sometimes it took half the day and sometimes it took half an hour. And I wrote a book, basically. It's not a book that anyone's ever likely to publish particularly, but it's my commentaries on Charlie's version of this 1,000-year-old teaching text. But part of what was happening on that journey for me was the experience of realizing why I'm not a Buddhist. Because there were things in this tradition that Charlie was operating in that are just different to how I see and understand and approach the world. And I'm not saying it doesn't have to be about who's right and who's wrong. It can be that, you know, I remember a philosopher I knew years ago saying, I say to my students, there are 6 good answers to this question. It's possible that you will find a 7th, but that will be a major event if you do. And so in that sort of spirit, you know, it's not necessarily the case that the kind of things that religion attempts to speak about or to gesture towards are the kind of things where there's only one answer or one good answer to them. But they may well be the kind of things where there's only a handful of good answers rather than just like anything that any of us comes up with and writes down on a piece of paper while we're having a trip being another great foundational... I'm pouring scorn on your father's deep profound insight there. but the thing that was coming through for me working with this Buddhist text was it often seems to me in conversations with friends who are involved with Buddhism that there is a kind of attitude to pain and suffering that sort of sees it as failure. That, you know, if we get the art of living right, then we can in some way escape from falling into pain and suffering. And I realize that I may be misrepresenting what a lot of people's experience of Buddhism is. But I do think that there is something distinct within the tradition that I grew up in. I mean, Alistair McIntosh, I've talked to him about this, and he's like, well, I think the thing that Christianity brings to the table of world religions is this, the centrality of the cross, the idea of a journey that passes through the wound, that passes through suffering, where suffering is not a mistake or the result of a lack of skill. Yes, there may be kinds of suffering and kinds of pain, which that is a good description of, but that doesn't cover the whole story. That actually, you know, and this feels to me true to the experience of my life and the experience of many of the lives that I've had insight into, that it's that the path goes through what feels very destructive in order to move towards what matters most. And I mean, look, there's a great deal that I don't know what to do with in the tradition that I grew up in. And there are things that just aren't there in the way they were even a generation ago. You know, I can't give my son, even if I wanted to, I can't give my son the experience of growing up in a community of children and adults of all ages that I had growing up around the church. Because if I walk into a church in Sweden today, I will be lucky to find anyone under the age of 70 who isn't on the payroll. But there are also things about the understanding of reality at the heart of that tradition that I do find myself drawn back to. I've not been tapped on the shoulder, not yet. I've not had the kind of dramatic experience that our friends Paul and Martin have been through. But in a quieter way, I do have a sense of being drawn home. You know, we did an episode about prayer last year, and I realized afterwards that I'd said a lot about prayer in that episode without really saying how I pray. And the truth is, I'll pray alongside anyone where there's the trust for them to make the invitation and me to accept it. And so I can find myself speaking the words of very different traditions. But there's still the moment in the middle of the night or in the evening, putting my son to bed, when prayer is called for. And the words I have are the ones that I grew up with. And when I say a prayer that's close to 2,000 years old, it feels like stepping inside a very old building that has mattered to an unimaginable number of people, where the stone is smoothed by the feet of everyone who came before me. It's a building where a mystery lives. And in the repetition of simple words that I've known all my life, I get glimpses of that mystery. Alan Garner says somewhere in one of his talks, I'm not exclusively Christian. Maybe that'll do for me for now. I don't want to claim too much, to pretend to anything more than the ruins of a faith. But maybe we can find each other among the ruins. How about you, Ed? You got any beliefs left for us?
Oh, I'm just having a moment of appreciation for those fine words, sir. I think I'd like to finish up with something on interbeing. You know, what Thich Nhat Hanh and people like Charles Eisenstein talk a lot about, but that interdependence and interconnectedness of all things, of all life, almost the kind of emergent autopoiesis, that auto self-generation and creation that comes and generates all this wonderful diversity and complexity through elegant simplicity, which actually sort of does have an echo with what you're saying about the simple words evoking that long history. Because I think the more you get into this idea of interbeing, that we contain multitudes and we ourselves are the ephemeral manifestation of just little temporary physical whirls and eddies in the fast-flowing river of time, but yet we go back with all of these deep common ancestors that we share with all life. And I've been reading Jeremy Lent's The Web of Meaning, that I kind of alluded to earlier when I mentioned The Web of Meaning, which was his potent follow-up to The Patterning Instinct. And you know, you mentioned patterns right at the beginning of this chat, and I'm really struck by that, because it seems to me an articulation of lots of things I've felt, and certainly lots of different elements of my own beliefs, but he's just done an incredible job of distilling and honing them in a way that makes real sense and really chimes. And it's a bit like that old Native American idea of all my relations, that, you know, we are all connected into this wider family of being. And I was sat on the deck the other evening at dusk discussing Jeremy's book with a friend, and I just reached my kind of exuberant conclusion of life begetting life, you know, when there were three very loud squeaks from under the opposite deck. And an otter, one of our otters, which I've never seen before. I've heard them regularly, but this otter swam directly across the river towards us. I mean, literally headed in a beeline towards where we were sitting, popped its head out of the water as if in enthusiastic agreement to go, yes, yes, yes. And then ducked under my little wooden rowboat and wriggled off upstream. And it was again, another of these beautiful moments of serendipity or synchronicity or connection, whatever or however we might wish to call it or label it. But either way, it was one of those moments that for me makes that point that I truly believe there is magic everywhere, even amongst the ruins on our humble knees, if we choose to see it.
Do you know, Ed, for a moment there, I thought you were going to tell me that the otter popped its head up and said, brick shit!
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. If you'd like to follow the threads in our conversations further, head over to homewardbound.org, where you'll also find my Substack, Writing Home. You'll find us on Facebook as The Great Humbling, and Ed is at FruCool on Twitter. We're always glad to hear from those of you who are listening, and we're deeply grateful for all that our listeners do to spread the word and bring these conversations to new ears by sharing the podcast along your networks and giving it ratings or reviews on the platforms where you listen. These are strange and humbling times, and we need quiet corners, breathing spaces, air pockets, and pockets of resistance. Places in which to puzzle through how we got here and where we might be going. Thank you for helping us create one of those pockets.